Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Jonah and Ben Play Board Games with Friends. I am Jonah, joined as always by my co-host Ben.
Hello, hello.
And today we are joined from Jake in Australia. Hello, Jake.
Hello.
How is Sunday morning treating you, and how will it treat us?
Sunday morning is pretty good. I'm not sure how it will treat you guys. We're in lockdown still in Melbourne.
So, staying indoors today then.
Yes.
It looks quite sunny out, though, based on the visual we've got that nobody listening can see.
It's overcast and just that bright overcast light that you get.
Wrong again.
Yeah, but you're going into spring as we're going into fall, right? Hemispheres and all that.
Yep. But again, Melbourne, you don't know what's happening. Four seasons in a day.
Right, yeah, I remember that.
This
Go on.
was about the time of year that I visited Australia when I went like September, like mid to late September ish. It was quite nice, except for when it was pouring rain when we decided we were gonna hit Sydney, Brisbane, Melbourne, and then we were gonna go up to Hamilton Island for like 4 days to end the vacation. And we got there and it was literally torrential downpours for, and then we looked at the weather and it was torrential downpours for like the next 4 days. And we literally canceled the hotel while we were on the island and switched our flight and grabbed another flight back to Sydney and spent the last week in Sydney. No, that was fun.
That's unlucky, both the weather and having to spend more time in Sydney.
Oh, we loved Sydney.
Ugh, sacrilege.
I mean, I know, Joan, I know we have discussed this before. We felt like Melbourne was just like New York City, which you vehemently disagree with.
Yeah. And Jake probably will as well, I'm sure.
I don't know.
I've not been to New York, so
I don't
I
know.
can't actually tell.
I will say they had that really sweet graffiti alley that I went to near the, I think it was near the, was that a train station? I'm forgetting half of this stuff
Yes,
now.
near
And
the
I
train
was,
station.
yeah, that was super cool. I took so many photos of that. But
Well, you can get some great photos at the moment because it's empty.
yes.
No tourists, lockdown.
Fair
Great
enough.
photos.
Jake, I have a stupid question for you.
Yes.
So, here in the Northern Hemisphere, and this is stupid because I lived down there near you forever or for a year. We associate the holidays, the winter holidays, with cold weather and stuff. And in my mind, December and January, I can just think of those 2 months and think those are cold months. Do you associate those 2 months with warmth? Despite,
Yes.
here's why I have this question though. With all of the movies and TV shows that show like a white Christmas and home for the holidays and it being frigid and all that, do you still associate December and January with heat?
Yes, December and January are heat summer holidays, essentially 2 months written off from work because everyone's either gearing up for Christmas or still on holiday. And then I still do think a white Christmas is a Christmas, but it's a strangely separate Christmas in my mind.
Interesting. Okay, good to know. I just remember we camped over Christmas weekend when we were down there, and it was very strange to be out on a sunny day and then camp for Christmas.
Yeah. Well, we definitely have had floods and hail on Christmas Day,
Oh,
so
delightful.
you can get everything you need.
Well, anyway, let's try and talk a little bit about board games. Jake, since it's your first time on the show, can you tell us all what game got you into the hobby, game or games, and what types of games you like to play these days?
So, one of the earliest games to get me properly into the hobby was paperback, which I believe you've talked about before. I, at the time, was living overseas. I had moved over for work, hadn't really slotted into feeling at home yet and was looking for things to do. So went on Meetup, joined a board gaming meetup, and yeah, started playing. So that was really where I started. Made me feel at home, made life a lot better there.
And where was there?
One of the, there was Hamburg, Germany. So I'm one of the first people to not have been introduced to board gaming by you, I think.
I was going to ask if before you started, I was going to ask if Jonah was the one, but you answered that.
So yeah, I took that with me back home, and then overseas again, and then back home, and met you when you were overseas and I was at home.
That's right.
And yeah, just continued on through there.
And I take it the meetup is not happening with COVID.
No, so I'd actually stopped going to the meetups. Kind of found a group of friends that we played all the games that we wanted. Took some of the pressure away from meeting new people.
Mm-hmm. And you didn't have to pay $2 to play games with your friends then.
Breaking the bank, yeah.
Yeah. It's funny because every time I tell people about the meetup that I went to down there where I met you and everyone else, everyone's shocked at the number that I always throw out for how many people would go to that meetup. You know, I say on a Tuesday night at a restaurant downtown, there would be like 70 people playing board games together.
It was quite a few. It was surprising.
Yeah. The meetups I've gone to here have been like 6 or 7 people in a food court. Not ideal.
I know that was our first meetup, so that was 6 or 7 people in a food court.
Yeah.
I mean, literally in the Rutgers University food court. But I was going to say about the interesting bit about charging people to come to a game night, I think that weeds out people who are not going to take it seriously. So I think it would probably end up, at least in my opinion, end up being a little more fun because you're going to end up playing with people who are actually going to want to be there and play the games as opposed to like a free meetup. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. I think also a reason they charged the $2 was because they had about 200 games there that you could use.
Yeah.
I can't say use for free because you pay $2 to get in.
Yep.
But.
And with 50 people a night, that's a new game every week, two games every week. So,
Well, why don't we start talking about the games that we have played recently for some of us and the last week for others. Jake, you want to start us off? What have you played lately?
So yesterday, my group finished the main storyline of Gloomhaven. So that was big fun. That's been a massive trek. We started when in the before times when we were all living within 20 minutes of each other. One of our group moved halfway across the country. We had multiple 8-hour each way road trips to play for a day or two and then head home.
Wow.
Massive stakes on each of the scenarios. If we'd get wiped, that was one scenario that we wouldn't be able to play again, and it'll push it to another session. Then with the lockdowns, we moved into playing a hybrid of the cards in our hands, the Gloomhaven Helper app on our phone, and the board on Tabletop Simulator.
Oh man.
So it was a little difficult, but it worked. And then, we finally got that finished yesterday and agreed that we would finish exactly after when we finished the story and pack that away until Frosthaven arrives.
So how many scenarios did you end up playing then?
It would have been 30 or 40, I think. Weren't keeping track too much of it. We just knew that for some of them, we'd give up and not do them again. The ooze scenario was impossible for us, so we just gave up and went a different way.
Awesome. And I take it was an enjoyable experience?
Yes, it was good fun. I think each of the different ways we played had different advantages and different ways to make it fun. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was all worth a laugh.
Awesome. And then you're just going to run it back when Frosthaven shows up?
Yep. Yep. I would try and persuade one of the players to move back to Melbourne, but that probably won't happen.
Ben, were you going to say something about Gloomhaven?
No, it was kind of a similar question to what you had asked, so it has been answered.
Excellent. Ben, why don't you tell us all what you've played this week?
Sure.
We'll just go around the wheel.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'll do one game and then we can keep going around, I guess.
Around the horn?
Unless you want me to do, like, every game I played this week, except for our game of the week. But I have played... I made a promise last week that I was going to be less boring this week. And I think that I have been less boring this week. I have played three games that are all new to me, one of them being our game of the week. The first one was a game with you that I'm sure you would like to talk about. So I will talk about the other one that none of you have played with me. And that is Unmatched Battle of Legends. Unmatched Battle of Legends, it's best at two players, from what I've gathered, but it can be played two, three, or four players. It can be taught in... I literally taught my brother in 5 minutes. So it's very easy, very quick to set up. Each game comprised of these various legends, hence the name, that are fighting each other on a board of your choosing. So it's kind of like a little mini skirmish game. And let's see, there are a few expansions out now, which is something to talk about later as well. But I have currently the base set and the Cobble and Fog set. So I'm going to list out the fighters that I could have picked from it before I get into the game. I could have picked Sinbad. So that's the pirate guy that I'm sure not many people know of.
The comedian?
No. Sinbad the pirate. Alice from Alice in Wonderland. King Arthur and Medusa. That is the first set. So you can literally like take these people and mix and match and fight Medusa against Sinbad, which is what my matchup was. And then the Cobble and Fog set, which I just got, is like a Victorian theme. And that has the Invisible Man, Dracula, Jekyll and Hyde, and Sherlock Holmes.
I don't know who the Invisible Man is.
If you've seen...
Is that bad?
You might not have... No, I don't think that's bad. To be honest, what they do to avoid a lot of licensing costs is take public domain characters and use them so they don't need to pay licensing fees to like use these characters. So some of them are a little out there, like Sinbad being like prominently featured in the first box is a little odd.
Jake, do you know who the Invisible Man is?
I'm aware of the Invisible Man, but not too much more than that.
But you haven't
seen
him? I definitely have not seen him.
Oh boy. I don't know if either of you guys have seen The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen or read the comics.
I think I saw 10 minutes of it on TV.
The Invisible Man is one of the characters that is featured in that movie/comic series. But basically, okay, he's an invisible man. but the game is essentially a skirmish game, and each character potentially has like a little sidekick token that they use. So each character is a little miniature, which I like. And the sidekicks are these little tokens, and each character has a deck of 30 cards. You move around the map by discarding cards or drawing cards to get different effects. So the cards are neat because they will either apply to any character on the board, being your minion is what they're called, or your hero, which is the miniature, or they're specific to the minion or hero. So if you pull in any card, you can spend that card to use any character on the board, but otherwise it's specific to the character. But where that kind of comes into play is some characters have really neat abilities on their cards, but it might be specific to a minion that might be dead. So that could be a useless card that you have to burn at some point. And the neat addition to this game that I thought was pretty cool is you never there's only 30 cards, but you never reshuffle and redraw cards. Once you are done and you need to draw a card, but you cannot, your character loses 2 health points, which is pretty extreme because the most I've seen anyone start with is 16 so far. Mm. But basically, you're running around the map, and there's like strategy on whether or not you want to like trap somebody into place. So I can explain how my game of Medusa versus Sinbad went. Medusa has 3 harpy miniatures, or 3 harpy minions. Sinbad has the porter, which is literally just this guy that carries around his stuff. And what was interesting about my game was my brother, who played as Medusa versus myself as Sinbad, he played an attack card against the porter in like the second turn of the game, where if he wins the combat, which he did, he deals an extra 8 damage because Medusa turns him to stone, and the porter only has 6 health. So I lost my porter in like the second turn.
That's bad.
And what's neat is you can move through your own characters, but you can't move through opponents' characters. So my brother had 3 minions and was basically just moving them around, trying to trap me in place. Because Medusa is a ranged fighter, so she can hit from like all over the board, which is kind of crazy. So I was like running around with Sinbad while he was trying to trap me in with these harpies. So
it
was a really cool back and forth. It worked for him. He ended up winning, which is normal, but I was very close. I got Medusa down to 2 health, and I literally just needed one more turn to win. But in the last turn, he managed to trap me in place, and when Medusa starts her turn in the same region as your character, she immediately deals damage to you. So I needed to get out and then back in, but I was unable to get back in before he was able to kill me. But it was really cool, and I know we're talking about expansions later, but I have since bought every expansion for the game because I want to use all the characters. And there are some licensed expansions. So Bruce Lee is an expansion. You know what? It's a little misleading to call them expansions. Bruce Lee is the only figure so far where you do require one of the other variants of the game. The other ones are standalone, but there's like 2-player packs and 4-player big boxes. But they all work together, so I consider them kind of expansions. But there's the 2 that I've got. There's a Jurassic Park expansion. There's going to be 3 Jurassic Park expansions, but only one is released. And that is the Raptors versus InGen. So if you remember in Jurassic Park, the guy who said clever girl and then got brutally demolished by some raptors, he's the InGen figure, and he goes up against 3 raptor miniatures. So I'm interested to try that when that comes in. And then there's Bigfoot versus Robin Hood, which seems neat. And then there's another expansion that's coming out that I haven't ordered yet, but I'm thinking about it. And that's Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And that's a 4-character big box. But each set, except for Bruce Lee, comes with a map that you can play on, whether it's 2-sided or 1-sided. But it's really cool. It plays in 20 to 40 minutes. I can't see it taking much longer than that, regardless of how strategic you can get, just because of that whole lose 2 health when you can't draw cards thing. But I'm interested to see how different characters match up against each other. I mean, after one game, I can definitely see some cool strategies with Sinbad, but I can also see how a melee-only character like Sinbad is tough against a ranged character like Medusa, who also hurts you for starting her turn in your zone. So, like, it costs me a lot of cards to run around the map, whereas my brother could just sit in like a central area and move his minions around. So I'm interested to see how different characters match up.
Cool. Sounds pretty replayable.
Yeah.
First game I want to talk about today is a game that you and I played together this week, Ben. It's called The King is Dead. Jake, have you ever heard of it?
No, I have not.
The King is Dead is a 2-4 player game that I don't know why anyone would ever play with other than 3 players. It plays in about half an hour, and it is kind of an area control political influence game. It is a game that takes place in the UK. One player, if you're playing this 3-player, one player is England, one player is Scotland, and one player is Wales, which of course begs the question, how could this game possibly work at 2 or 4 players? Who knows? Who knows? 4-player, I think, is 2v2. With only 3 factions, really don't understand it. So that's why we played it 3-player.
No Island?
No, Ireland, yeah. I was looking at the map and they just, they were forgotten about. That's the four-player expansion, I guess. So what's really interesting in this game is two things. One, it is a game that every player has the same eight cards in their hand. So you know what everyone else can do, and whenever someone plays a card, you can see it, of course, but you can only see their topmost card. So after two or three plays, you might forget what the other people have used. And the other interesting thing about this game is you kind of want to not do anything. This game is very much the best move is not to play, and you can pass on your turn. So there are nine rounds, and you only have eight actions. And once all players pass in a row, the round just ends, and a little like political conflict gets figured out. And it was really interesting. I thought it was neat. It feels really bad to just have to do something to stop someone else from winning. So in this game, Ben was set up to win if me and Nick didn't do anything. So it was Ben's turn, then Nick's turn, then my turn. Ben does something. Nick realizes that if he does something, it stops Ben from winning. Nick also realizes if he does nothing, I have to do something to stop Ben from winning. So, Jake, I can see you're smiling. You know what's going to happen here. Nick passes. I'm forced to deal with the situation. And, yeah, it felt really bad to use two cards watching Nick pass just to prevent Ben from winning. Now, later on, I got in this situation where Ben passed and Nick had to play a card to stop me from winning. So it came full circle.
And I would just like to note really quick in that situation where Nick passed, I was already a few cards beyond where you guys were in terms of using them. So for me, from my perspective, once your cards are out, you are out. You literally do nothing for the rest of the game but pass. So burning your cards early can be rough, but I thought that I was in a decent position. And then I quickly realized as Nick is passing and Jonah's doing something that would stop me from winning, I need to burn another card to try and get to a position where I can win again. And I just kept going down and down, and it eventually turned into a point where I was down to one card, and I think, Jonah, you were down to two cards, and if there's a tie on the victory condition, the player who most recently played a card wins. So I was screwed because I was never going to get to a point where I was going after Jonah. Because
right,
I
which
already
is why
burned
passing
my cards.
Is the winning move so much yep. in this game. Which yep. is strange, because there's a slightly random... I mean, it's a random setup, and there are only three types of influence, the Scottish, the Welsh, and the English. And each player starts with two cubes drawn from the bag, and the cubes can be one of three colors, of course, the three factions. And, you know, if you're positioned well from your starting cubes, you're really encouraged to just... pass and pass and pass. And I thought it was interesting.
Is this a little bit like Tsukiji Fish Market, where turn order has a big impact on how it will go?
I want to say yes, but in a game where each person only has eight actions and the turn order never really changes that much, not so much, because the way you become first player in the next turn is by being the first person to pass in a series of three passes. But I don't know. There's not enough turn order manipulation for me to think that.
Yeah, I would kind of agree, but at the same time, I had some feels bad moments because I literally never was one to pass first. So I across both games, I never went first. So it was a little tough for me to get to that position, Jonah, where I would potentially go after you.
Right.
Because I never went first. So I was always going last or second when the turn order shifted. But that was the nature of me playing cards and not passing early. So,
yeah, that is The King is Dead. Plays in half an hour.
I liked it. I just
thought it was pretty neat.
To throw my thoughts in there. Yeah, I thought it was a little lightweight political intrigue game, which I thought was neat. I agree.
Jake, what else did you play?
I played some Fantastic Factories, which I think you've spoken about before. Yep. I'm preparing for the expansion, or plural expansions, that are on Kickstarter at the moment, which I think we might talk about a bit later in the show. But that was a quick round, kind of decompressing from Gloomhaven, a lot lighter theme. A bit more cutesy on the cards, but yeah, it was a good wind down.
Did you play it solo, two player?
So that was three player with the Gloomhaven group.
Oh, cool.
So that was two of us had played before, and one was their first play, but they really played pretty well once they got their head around it.
How long did it take? Like 15 minutes? That's a good quick one, right?
Yeah, 15, 20. Again, tabletop simulator, so that adds a couple of minutes.
Yeah. Yeah, some games tabletop simulator really cuts it down. Like if with Gloomhaven, you know, getting rid of half an hour of setup and teardown, but other games that are already light and easy can really slow it down.
Yep.
Back to me. Okay. I also played... I'm going to save a couple games for discussion for weeks when I'm boring, but I played a lot of Village Pillage last night. Village Pillage, have I talked about Village Pillage? I feel like I've mentioned it, but I don't know if I've legit talked about Village Pillage.
I think you have, but really quickly, Jake, have you played this? Because this is right up your Kickstarter alley.
I've heard of it, but I can't remember it.
I'm trying to see if this is even like available. Okay, it is on Amazon. It's available. Oh, perfect. Because Kevin, one of the friends that I introduced to disc golf, he was my brother's roommate in college, but he started coming over for game nights because we've been hanging out anyway, so he is coming over. But we had an in-person Village Pillage game night. And to me, Jonah, you and I have played this at a few different player counts. I personally think it's best at three.
Oh, I would agree just based on how the game works.
Yep. And I will go over how the game works right now. Village Pillage, it's kind of like a rock, paper, scissors-esque. What a segue. It's kind of like a rock, paper, scissors-esque card game. So everybody starts with the same four cards. There are categories of cards which are farmers, walls, merchants, and raiders.
Citrus is one of those, I think.
Citrus?
Yeah, one of them, the little icon is
the farmer, it's supposed to be a wheel, but yeah, it kind of looks like a citrus.
It's an orange slice.
It's on a green card, to be fair. It's on a green card, so it's not an orange slice.
It's a clementine.
In any case, on each turn, you are choosing one card to play against your opponent to the left of you, and one card to play against the opponent to the right of you. And you put the cards face down until everybody's ready to reveal. And if a certain type of card goes up against a certain other type of card, various effects get resolved. But in terms of like the order in which they get resolved, the farmer happens first, then the wall happens, and then the raider happens, and the merchant acts last. The merchant is important because to win the game, you need to accumulate enough turnips to spend to buy relics. So you need to buy three relics to win. So the first relic costs 8 turnips, the second relic costs 9 turnips, and the final relic costs 10. And you need to buy them in order, and you can only buy one at a time. So we got to a point where Kevin was at like 30 turnips, but he couldn't do anything with it. But there are also extra cards that are put out into a market row. So when you play the merchant, if you don't have enough turnips to buy a relic, you need to buy a card for one turnip from the market row, which will give you more choices to play during the game. But all of the cards fall into raider, farmer, wall, or merchant.
Citrus.
But they have different effects versus other things. So for example, a raider cannot steal when they're going up against the wall because the wall blocks the raider. However, the wall will be able to do something against that raider in retaliation while also gaining a turnip for themselves. And it's kind of a neat little rock, paper, scissors because everything resolves simultaneously. So if a farmer goes first and takes however many turnips they take, if one person raids against you while you raid against somebody else, like, things can be shifted and taken before someone else's card will resolve. So it's possible for like, the wall to get you a turnip right before somebody raids you and takes that turnip that you just got. Yep.
Now, Ben, if I'm playing this game four player and the person across from me at the table is winning, what do I do about that?
Yeah, so if the person across from you is winning, and this is where Kevin managed to accumulate all those turnips, typically you want to raid against that person because you want to steal turnips from them so they can't buy things. The issue is, they might know that people are going to want to steal from them, so they will try and play a wall against you. And the issue we came up against with Kevin is he bought another wall, so he was able to play, like, when he had like 30 turnips, he was playing like two walls at a time. So, like, my brother and I could not steal anything from him for like a bunch of turns. And then at that point, even if we did steal from him, he had so many turnips that he could just buy the relics to win. But it's really neat because it's not a cooperative game, but you need to work with the person on the other side of the person you're against, because if you don't coordinate, kind of, you can have some issues.
But what if it's a four-player game and there's a person across from me who's winning? What can I do about that, Ben?
Oh, I didn't understand your question. I'm sorry. That's the thing. You cannot do anything about that. Because in a four-player game, you're only playing against the left and right. This is why I like three players, because you're interacting with everybody. If it's more than three players, there are going to be players that you are not interacting with at all. So you're relying on other players to keep them in check. But I still really enjoy the game. I've played it. It's up to six. It's got a mini expansion that lets it go up to six. And I do enjoy it, but to answer Jonah's question correctly, yes, there is nothing you can do at more than three players about some players at the table with you, which is one downside. Another one with expansions coming in from Kickstarter, so we're going to have a really good talk later. Yeah, there's some expansions coming that I'm looking forward to that are going to change this one up a little bit.
Excellent. We will definitely chat about that in the expansions segment later on tonight.
Yep.
I will close off this segment with a two-player game that I played for the first time called Battle Line. Do either of you know this game? Two head shakes.
Oh, sorry, no. Vocally, no.
Podcast.
Sorry, this I keep forgetting that only you and medium. I can see each other. And Jake. But yes, no, I have not heard of Battle Line until you mentioned it.
So Battle Line is a game by Dr. Reiner Knizia, a crazy man who has designed over 500 board games. And one might ask themselves, how can someone design over 500 board games? And the answer is, a lot of them are re-implementations of other ones. And that is probably more reductive than I should be. But I played Battle Line, which is the same as his other game, Schottentotten, who knows how to pronounce it, just with some more cards added. So, you know, while we talk about games getting expansions, this is just the same game re-released with a different name and different cards in it, or different cards added. Anyway, Battle Line, really neat two-player game. You have a deck of 60 cards, and in this 60-card deck, there are six colors numbered 1 through 10 in each color. And at the center of the table, there are nine little pawns to represent the nine flags on this line that you are battling over. So each player will just have seven cards in their hand, and you will take turns putting a card on your side of one of those pawns, and you are trying to fight over each pawn. And to win the game, you must be in control of either five of those pawns, five of those nine pawns, so more than half, or three adjacent pawns. That makes it really interesting for which ones you're willing to take the loss on and which ones you're willing to go for. And the way you claim one of these pawns is you either have a three in a row flush, so three in a row of the same suit. That is the highest thing you can have. Next thing you can have is a flush, three of the same color, then three of a kind, etc. And this is another game where you kind of don't want to play, just like in The King is Dead, because if I put a blue nine behind a pawn, that can give away what else I might be putting behind that as well. I thought Battle Line was really neat. It played in like 15 or 20 minutes, and I also am not a big fan of that many two-player only games, so this was a definite thumbs up for me.
Just super quick question. Have you heard of Dogs of War from Cool Mini or not?
Yes. I think Patrick has it and enjoys it.
Would you say this is somewhat similar, but like a pared down version? Because it sounds like it has that like tug of war aspect in terms of battling over like specific things. So I know in Dogs of War, you are throughout the game, and it's more than two players, but you're like battling over specific houses, I think it is called. And like you're trying to shift the allegiances like toward you through like fighting over them.
My knowledge of the game Dogs of War is that it is a game. So I don't know.
Okay. I didn't know if that sounded like it was along the same lines or not. But fair enough.
Next time we have Patrick on, we can find out.
Fair. I'm sure he'll tell us after he listens.
The final game that we all played this week was a game that we played together and is our game of the week. Jake, what is that game and what is that game?
The game of the week is Innovation. Innovation is a journey through innovations from the Stone Age through modern times. Each player builds a civilization based on various technologies, ideas, and cultural advancements. It is a tableau building game involving, in the base set, over 100 cards. Each player gets to choose from the actions of doing, playing a card, scoring an achievement, or a dogma, which is the actions on the cards on their tableau in front of them. From the four basic actions you can take, especially with the dogma, it unfolds into a huge combination of actual actions you can take.
Excellent. That was a wonderful description of the game. Can you tell us about splaying? Because that is in this game, and I've only ever seen splaying in one other game.
Okay, so to go back a little bit, with the dogma action, you can do what it says on one of your cards that you've played, but depending on the symbols shown on your tableau, other people are either forced to follow through a demand or can share in the action. The symbols on your cards, there are six different symbols, including factories, castles, crowns, etc. They are on the card in an L shape, so there's two on the left and three along the bottom. When you play cards, you'll play cards directly on top of each other, which covers up symbols. But through some dogma actions, you can splay the cards left, which will show one symbol from each of the cards underneath the card you splay, right, which shows two, or up, which shows three. So you can demand or share more often, depending on how many symbols you've shown by splaying.
That was a fantastic explanation.
Thank
Very
you.
Very prompt, to the point.
Tell us more about Innovation.
So, as I said, the main part of the game are the dogmas. At the start of the game, they can be as easy as draw an extra card, score a card. But as you play through the levels of cards, they get a lot more complex, including discard a card. If you do, draw another two cards and score a card. In one of the expansions, a very high level card literally just says you win. If you play that, you have to make sure that no one else can share. So you have to have the most icons for that card, or someone else will get to share before you and win because of what you've done. And yeah, it can get a little bit aggressive, which I think both of you know. Some of the demands, yeah, can go a bit far, and the only way to defend is by getting more of those icons out.
Right, there's kind of an interesting bit of defense that you play with the cards, because if you see someone else has an I demand action on leaves, then you want to really play a lot of your cards that have leaves on them to shore up your defenses. Because when you demand something, you can only demand something from someone who has fewer of that icon than you, correct?
Yep.
Yeah, so I thought that's a really interesting part of the game. I think splaying is also a really cool part of the game. And just like all other tableau builders and engine builders, I really enjoyed the progression from the age 1 cards up to the age 10 cards. You know, the cards get definitely, you know, more involved and more advanced, but also I just think cooler. I think the cards get much cooler as the game progresses, which is a great feeling in a board game.
It does escalate very quickly the further up the chain you get. From turns that take 2 seconds to just draw an extra card, to looking at everyone else's board, drawing cards, putting cards down, depending on what you see, it definitely escalates.
Yeah, another great thing for innovation is those combos. You know, not just cool cards, but cool combos. Because a lot of people really enjoy, and I know Ben really enjoys this, is when you can make a great big combo happen on a turn. You know, you have this card, which triggers that card, which does this effect, which does that thing. And that is just a really great feeling that happens a lot in innovation. But I must also say, which is also what you just alluded to, anytime something great happens to you in innovation, it seems to be at the expense of another or the other players. Which might not be for everyone.
One of, if not the swingiest game I've ever played.
Yeah.
Especially two players, because Joan, I know you and I played it two players before we all played it together. And there was literally a point where I was like building up a score, and you just kept playing a card that was like, discard a score card. And then if you discarded a score card, also discard the same value card from your tableau. So like, it never allowed me to build up in any way, shape, or form the ability to overcome whatever your symbol was to stop you from demanding that of me. So it was like just constant back and forth of me like losing a score card and a card. But I couldn't draw enough cards fast enough to get the symbols to stop it. It was very, 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 very swingy, because I was like finally getting close to achieving for points, and then suddenly, nope, you can barely do anything.
At least that does bottom out when you run out of scorecards, though.
That's fair.
That's right, if you want to play it to that end. I think Innovation is a really neat game, and I would definitely play it anytime someone asked me to play it. But I think it is a little too stabby for me.
I usually don't like stabby games, but I just feel like this, it could be because it is so swingy. You get one card out and it shifts the entire game. Mm-hmm. And it goes from one card will be so overpowered until the next card is overpowered. Mm-hmm. And so just building up on that, I suppose the stabby, swingy, overpowered cards balances it out for me.
Yeah, it's definitely really cool. I just want to mention the other game that I played that has splaying in it, because it is, I think, a really uncommon mechanic, not even worth having as mechanic on the week, because then it's just, here's this game and here's this other game. The other game that I played is called ... and then we held hands.
I've heard of it.
Jake, have you played it?
I have not, but holding hands is a good time.
It's delightful. And then we held hands uses this, and you just have your cards, and they can all be splayed left or right. There are only two icons on each card, if I recall correctly. I haven't played it in like 5 years. And it just does the same thing with splaying left or right, just with one icon instead of two, three, or one icons.
It's a neat mechanic. It's listed as one of my positives, along with ramp up. And those are my only two positives.
Well, Ben, before we get to your negatives, which I know there are a few,
yes,
I just want to let Jake know that he is in rare company as far as playing board games with you. Because Jake has been a part of two of your three least favorite games.
Yes.
And Jake,
I'd like to just say really quickly, apologies for also being part of literally the only two games that I can remember ever playing where I've verbally commented during a game on how much I don't like the game.
I'm just thinking about what the common denominator here is.
I don't know. I'm not saying it's you, because I don't think it's you. It might just be the type of game.
Jake, do you know what the other game is? It's so sad.
Could you educate me about it?
Let's just say I gave you and Jonah about 600 points, and Patrick and myself got like 100 total points, and I got like negative 300 points. And its name is Its name is Tichu. And the only other game, Jonah, you have the rare distinction of being a part of all three of my bottom three games.
Yeah, well, that's
and,
fine.
And that would be Tichu, Indonesia, and now this one. At least as of this moment, those are my bottom three. But I would willingly play Tichu again. I probably would not play this or Indonesia again, personally.
Tichu, you were just flat out wrong about.
I mean, I disagree, but I'd at least give it another shot to see if I'm flat out wrong about it.
Jake, how great is Tichu?
Tichu is great.
Excellent.
Well, I'm just gonna blame it on Patrick.
You can talk about what you didn't like about Innovation now.
Okay, that's fine. I'll be the negative here. I will say I think one of my negatives is a fault of both Board Game Arena, which is one of the platforms we played it on, as well as Tabletop Simulator. I thought that Board Game Arena was easier to play on, but also very hard to follow, because unless you're reading the history, things happen so fast because it takes care of it for you. Mm-hmm. So I was kind of like watching things happen instead of like learning why things were really happening, if that makes sense.
So on the difference between platforms, we played the game on tabletop and it took 2 and a bit hours.
Yep.
A two-player game on Board Game Arena can take 10 minutes.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, our three-player game first on Board Game Arena, I think, was half an hour. And then our three-player game on Tabletop Simulator was an hour and a half, which is insane. Anyway, go on, yep. Ben.
So I think just on that alone, it was a little tough for me to follow on Board Game Arena just because things happen so fast. But I do appreciate how fast it happened, because it took a lot of the like guesswork out of it. And it also gave a nice handy little tool tip that if you hovered over something, it would say like, if you take this action, Jonah will also be able to share in this action because of how many leaf symbols he has. So it was nice in that regard. But like when I wasn't the one doing an action, it was happening so quickly that it was a little difficult for me to follow. On Tabletop Simulator itself, and I think this might actually just be the case in the game as well, so it's going to go into one of my other ones with another negative of mine. I think there was just too much to keep track of for me in this.
That's on my negatives for all tableau builders, which we'll talk about later.
Because like you said earlier, Jake, there's like 100-something cards. Did you say 190 cards?
I think it's 105 in the base set.
Yeah. A across 100 cards, 105 cards, there's all of this information that you need to keep track of. But if it's not in your tableau and it's in someone else's tableau, you also need to like peer over the table and see that it's on their tableau and worry about what they're going to do to you. There was just a lot of stuff to keep track of, I thought, that made it difficult for me to keep track of, which is not something I enjoy really doing in my games, I guess, keeping track of like every little bit of info that other people also have.
It's good that Board Game Arena and Tabletop Simulator both had counters for each icon.
Yes, because that did help.
Playing this game in person, you do have to like peer over and try and count the icons to tell. Right, Jake?
Yeah, it's in person. It's a little bit easier to try and keep track of your own icons. And when it comes to a dogma action, you just say, I'm doing this on 5 leaves, and everyone else has to say how many leaf symbols they have to play.
So interestingly enough, I think that would make me like it less in person than I did on these platforms, because for me, and this is where, Joan, I know you and I are going to disagree because I mentioned this before, I didn't feel like there was any strategy for me other than looking at the symbols and trying to get above you guys. I didn't know what else I could do other than trying to get above you with the symbols. And that might be attributed to how much information there was for me to try and keep track of. But for me, it just felt like I was playing a game of get higher numbers with symbols, as opposed to like scoring cards, I guess. I don't know. It was a little weird for me. Meanwhile, I did win a game, which is a surprise to me. That's imposter syndrome once again setting in. Most of the time I win, it's imposter syndrome. That actually brought up a good point for me. In terms of scoring, it goes into my randomness category. I don't really get myself, because I know I like games with dice and stuff. Like, so I like randomness. But for some reason in this game, I felt like I couldn't negate the randomness at all. I don't know why. I felt like I struggled to negate the randomness of like some dogma said, draw a card. If you happen to draw this card, draw another card. If you happen to draw another one of those cards, draw another card. And it was like, I didn't feel like there was anything I could do to negate, like, oh, I just drew a crap card off of this, so it didn't string together to make a combo. But meanwhile, one of you guys is sharing in it, and since you go first, oh, you just drew that card, now you're drawing like a whole combo of cards, and I got screwed out of that. It was a bit weird to me. I felt like I couldn't do much to stop that from happening in terms of like the randomness level. And that ties into our first game, Jonah, in 2 players. It took me like 5 or 6 turns before I got a card that would let me score another card. So like it took a while. And I think what I've learned over all of these games is that I don't draw cards enough. And I think that the strategy of this game is to just churn cards like hardcore.
I mean, anytime there's randomness in games, the way you mitigate that randomness is by doing the random event more, you know? If you want to roll a number higher than a 1, try rolling a d6 5 times, and it's probably going to happen. If you roll it once, might not happen.
That's fair. I might have just had a bad way of playing the game that piled into making me think that it just was impossible to negate just based on what I pulled. But again, right, there's 105 cards with a lot more information that I didn't get, that maybe one of those would have helped me more than the cards I did end up getting.
Yeah, I mean, any game with this card draw randomness in it is going to feel pretty random. And, you know, I am happy to embrace the randomness in something like this for like half an hour. But in something like Shia, you know, I don't want to roll dice for 4 hours, which you're happy to do. So it's interesting.
And to me, I think in terms of that specific game, it's because there's other stuff on the board I can do anyway, like on top of the randomness, there's other stuff I can do. I felt like this one was just all about getting lucky with a card draw, and then that lucky card draw gave you more symbols to now be able to do an action. I don't know. I think the randomness tie. Yeah, and it's weird because I agree. She is the most random game I've ever played, but like I love it. It's in my top 3, top 5. I don't even know anymore. It shifts. But I don't know. I felt this one specifically, it was just the randomness was a little difficult for me to like get beyond.
Talking about randomness, do you think this is randomness that happens late, or that happens early that you then have to react to? Because I know you've both talked about that before.
What do you mean?
Like especially, sorry, given you've got two actions per turn, can you get the randomness out of the way early and then come back from that? Or is it final?
I think that, like Jonah said, like if you just draw more cards, I think that would help get around it. But again, you could also just get unlucky and not have a card that would even allow you to score points for a good chunk of the game. Which, to me, like, that part makes it hard to get around. So maybe if it started with, like, everybody had the same two cards, like these other games we've been talking about, so you at least know what some other people can do, like, at the beginning. But then after that, as you're drawing the cards, they get random. Maybe that would have improved it for me, just to have, like, a card right from the start that would say, oh, score a card. And everyone has the ability to do that, and you kind of know what's coming. I don't know.
Yeah, it's interesting because, I mean, first of all, Jake, I think that was a really good point. You know, being able to do the random thing on your first of two actions to then try and deal with it, that is definitely the best way to try and handle the randomness and then have more agency in your second decision. I think it is really interesting, however, that the two actions that you can do, or the three actions that you can do, are draw a card. Oh, God, four actions. The actions that you can do, draw a card, play a card, do something on that card, and achieve something. And you need to achieve six things. I guess it changes based on the player count, but you need to get X achievements to win. So you can draw cards, play cards, do the stuff on cards, and achieve stuff as what you can do. The one thing you cannot do is score a card, which is interesting because doing the actions on the cards can let you draw more than the one card draw action. But nowhere is there the ability to score this card except for getting it on a card. So you can mitigate a lot of the randomness because if you can achieve something, you just do it. You just take that action. If you want to draw a card, you just do it. But the very crucial part of scoring is card dependent, right?
Yes. And I think that is the point for me. Because even when you can take two actions, you have to draw a card to try and get one that you could score, but then you need to play that card. And then someone else's turn can make you draw a card and play it, which might go on top of that card that lets you score, and then you can't even score again. Which is where the swingy part comes into.
If someone is scoring a lot, though, you can try and out-icon them and try and share in what they're doing. I suppose if you're not being attacked directly, you're not going to lose that card as much.
Right, because if someone's scoring and achieving, they are not beefing up their cards, right? That's kind of the trade-off with going for points or the victory. So, Jake, any closing thoughts on innovation?
And another thought I did have about it, and this changed the more I thought about it, was the theme. I'd like to get your thoughts on the theme before I start talking about it. I thought so. So when I first thought about the theme, I had the same thought. What theme? You can play the actions not thinking about the themes. But I think, is it Tudyk? Yeah, Tudyk.
Yeah, Carl.
Has thought about it with the theme. Each card has a name, and it's a technology, or it's, in some expansions, a certain person. And each of those ties in surprisingly well to the action on the card. So there's a card, Gunpowder. It damages people who haven't progressed past castles on their tableau. And so you think about that, and yeah, it fits. Later in the game, you can get a card that you demand someone else draws a card. If it's red, it essentially wipes the game. So there's a 20% chance of starting the game essentially from scratch. And that is fission. So you think following fission down the path to nuclear weapons, you could wipe the entire world. So I think there is a theme there that you just have to think about a little bit more.
I think you're right. And I think the only reason, and this is
really not an intelligent comment that I'm about to make. It's hard to say that a game has theme if you can play the entire game and not realize that that theme is there. Because, I don't know, this is probably a really bad take, but there are tons of games that the theme is super apparent and you can't say it doesn't have theme. And, I don't know, in innovation, you're totally right. You know, all the cards that I have played, if I look at the name and the action, it makes sense. If I think about innovation and how starting with, you know, a canoe and some oars, because I think oars is one of the cards, you know, starting with that and then getting onto, I don't know, physics later on, I think is a card name, you can really see the progression. You can really see the innovation from this older lack of technology or the older technology to the current technology. But I think the fact that it can be so easily overlooked makes it feel less like there is a theme than there is.
I kind of agree with both points. I definitely think that there's a theme throughout in terms of like progressing to the next age. But I also agree, I wasn't really thinking about it throughout the game, like, hey, this card ties into this, like the gunpowder thing, when you just mentioned that, was kind of like a little, oh, yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
But I, like, during the game, I'm just like, oh, these have a bunch of castles on them. Like, that's what I thought of the cards. Now, the one that came up on my deck, which I thought was really neat, was in the 10th age, which is the last, or the highest number card you can get. There's AI, robotics, and software. And that was a neat combo that I liked when we were playing, because I got AI, and AI gave you like some really powerful effect that I can't think of right now. But if you play the dogma on the AI card when robotics and software are also played as a top card on someone's tableau, you lose the game, which is, like, in my opinion, it's like Terminators are taking over. So, like, that was kind of neat. So that specific combo I thought about, but only because it literally was on the card saying, if these are out there, you lose the game. And then I'm like, oh, AI, robotics, software, that's kind of cool. But I think other than that, I was mostly just thinking about the symbols and not really about their connection to each other. If that makes sense.
I suppose in one of the expansions, there's paper, scissors, and eventually you can unlock rock. It does mean rock music, but if you play that when there's scissors out, I think you win. So,
oh,
I like that.
That's funny. That I like. Should we talk about expansions or should we go into tableau builders? What do you think? Because we're talking about a lot of expansions already.
We're going to go into tableau builders first.
Okay.
And with this, that fantastic in-podcast segue,
yeah,
no jingle required, let's talk about tableau builders. Jake, what is a tableau builder, even though we already kind of know?
So a tableau builder is a game where each player has a visible personal array or tableau of components, usually cards, but can also be tiles or player boards, which they purposefully build or manipulate throughout the game by spending actions or resources, including opportunity costs, and which determines the quality, quantity, and or variety of actions to which they have access throughout the game.
Wow, fantastic. Ben, what is the question that you asked before we started recording?
Yeah, so I was going to ask the question anyway, even though I asked before we were recording, but the question that I asked earlier is, what is the difference between a tableau builder and an engine builder?
Jake, what is the answer to this excellent question?
Well, it is said that the difference is that tableau building is a physical part of the game, and engine building is more of a logical part. So where tableau is actually what's out on your table, engine building is more how you play the game with strategy.
Right, and I think I really oversimplified it earlier to just say you can have an engine builder without cards, and I don't think you can have a tableau builder without cards.
Or tiles.
Or tiles, yeah. So that's really
a crucial part of it. Just a physical component. And that makes sense. I was asking that question, and I was going to ask that question because they feel very similar-ish to me, at least the ones that I've played. So I was asking that question because I wasn't 100% sure how they differ all that much, but both of those answers make a lot of sense now that I hear them.
There is a large overlap, I think.
Yeah. So Innovation is your favorite Tableau builder, Jake.
Probably. Yes, it is.
I think one of my favorites is Pax Pamir 2nd Edition. We've talked about that a time or two before. Ben, what's one of your favorites?
I mean, I'd probably say Pax Pamir just because other than that, most of my favorite Tableau builders are probably engine builders. So
That's allowed.
Oh, okay. Well, now I have to think about a different genre of game. But I do really like Pax Pamir, so I'm going to say Pax Pamir because it is a straight Tableau builder, not an engine builder.
Mm-hmm. So one thing that I really like about Tableau builders, which is also what I really like about engine builders, is the ability to have things ramp up, just like we were talking about in Innovation. You know, anytime you have a Tableau builder, even without cards getting more powerful, just getting more of them in front of you is going to mean you can do more things. And I think that leads to interesting gameplay. And it also, you know, movies always have three acts to them. And I think a board game can really have different acts to it if you have this huge ramp up. There's really a big difference between when you had one card in front of you at the beginning and eight cards in front of you towards the end.
I agree. Now, excellent. I guess one more question. Would you say that there's a large overlap between Tableau building and set collection, or is that dependent on the game entirely because some set collection games, the cards or sets you're collecting literally do not impact the game further beyond points?
I think there's an overlap in some games, yes. But in others, not so much. With Innovation, say, there are definitely combinations that work really well. And the more you play, the more you see those as sets. But it's not a set per se. But then in other games, so thinking maybe Unfair, a game about a fun fair, there are sets in some of the decks where you do have to build a tableau, they call it, or a panorama where you've got different cards that actually make a larger image and you collect the set. So as well as doing the actions that you've got by building those individual cards, you also score points by having the panorama and collecting that set.
I'm glad you brought up playing more and seeing more of the cards to then realize that something might be a set or might not, because a negative that I have for all Tableau builders, which you can really apply to all board games as well, but I think is especially apparent in Tableau builders, is you really have to play the game a lot and know a lot of the cards to understand what's going on and to be able to make any attempt at strategy planning.
Yeah. And that was one of my negatives. And I think
for Innovation,
I would agree there. Well, for Innovation, yeah. But I think maybe in general with Tableau building, because for me with engine building versus Tableau building, not to make this like a comparison the whole time, it's just I literally had the question of engine building versus Tableau building right from the start. I think engine building, you see the results of the engine on the board.
Right.
But Tableau building, I need to know exactly what you have at all times. If that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, the other negative that I was going to say is, you know, the negatives that you mentioned for Innovation, I think, are really just negatives about Tableau building. Because in Tableau building, you need to see a bunch of cards all around the table, which is not easy. And you need to know a lot of the cards, which is not easy in your first couple plays.
Yep. Yes, it's possible. I'm just not a big, at this point, Tableau building fan. And that might have swung over into Innovation more so than the game itself. I don't know. Look at you changing minds, Jonah, or potentially changing minds.
So, Jake, what do you like about Tableau building?
I do like, I suppose, the little bit of crossover with engine building. I like the puzzle aspect of it. You find combinations. You expand out. The ramping up that you're talking about is really nice as well when you can get it kicking in.
And any negatives?
I can see the negative. Sometimes it can work out to be multiplayer solitaire. When you've got your own tableau, you are playing a very different game to other people depending on their tableau. For me personally, that's not a massive issue because it can remove, this is exactly the opposite of what happened in Innovation, but it can remove some stabbiness.
Right. And I think that's what Innovation actually does really well, is it combats the whole multiplayer solitaire feeling you can get with tableau builders by forcing you to look at how many icons everyone else has, and also by having so much player interaction on the cards. You know, just because the card is in front of you doesn't mean it doesn't affect anyone else at the table.
I suppose the sharing action helps. So even when you're not stabbing other people, are picking up from your actions as well.
Do you have any other favorites besides Innovation?
I've already talked about Fantastic Factories, and I will again. That, as the base set is, that's a lot more solitaire, and again, an engine builder. Heavy on the engine building.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why you have a factory, right?
I'm going to amend my favorite tableau builder because I'm looking through the whole list of tableau builders so that I'm picking a tableau builder and not an engine builder, even though they might overlap. And another game, once again, I forgot about, which I forgot about on a podcast episode a couple weeks ago, Millennium Blades, is a tableau builder as well. And
oh, definitely.
That probably would be up there. Although I almost feel obligated, according to BGG, Anachrony is a tableau builder, which to me, I would disagree, but I feel obligated to say that's my favorite just because it's like one of my top three games. But I would say out of games I actually agree with, Millennium Blades is probably my top. PAX is a good one though as well.
And finally today, we are going to talk about expansions. And before we dive into this topic, I want to posit something. This is something that I already said to Ben earlier, so Jake, you're just going to have to react in real time to this. But for me, expansions to board games come in two flavors. It's either more of the same, and let's switch things up a bit. And I think some games definitely really benefit from an expansion being more of the same. And of course, other games benefit from an expansion being, let's switch things up a bit. But sometimes those can each backfire. And I think we should talk about those in a bit. But first, what are some of your favorite expansions? How do they shake up the base game? And what do you like so much about them?
I can... Yeah, go Jake's ahead. Going. Jake, you can go. You are
so
the guest.
To continue a theme, Innovation has...
Oh, what's that?
It's a nice little tableau build. No, it has four expansions at the moment. So I actually purchased Innovation as Deluxe, which is all five sets. Each expansion adds a lot to the base game. I made you both sit through one of the expansions, Echoes. So Echoes adds a new mechanic where in splaying the cards, you can also open up new actions on some of the cards that you've covered. So that definitely adds a lot, a new level of strategy. So it increases the importance of splaying, and opens up some new achievements, new ways to win, new combinations as well. The other expansions also add new mechanics of different levels of complexity. But to get all five expansions out on the table, you need, or to get all five sets on the table, you need a very large table, and you probably need a very large level of concentration to keep track of all of the rules. So where those four actions originally were, that opens it up to, I think, six or seven different actions, which all have minor tweaks.
Now, I have a question about Echoes specifically. Was Echoes chosen because it is your favorite, because it is the easiest of the other sets, or both?
Or neither.
Or neither.
A bit of both. So it was the first expansion I ever played. It's the expansion that I've played the most, so I'm most around it. I could teach it a little bit easier, and it does add more. So it was a good balance of complexity and complexity. So it was in the Goldilocks zone for adding to the game.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I would like to just state one thing because it just came to mind. If the entire game of Innovation was just Echoes, I would like it. Because I like the extra potential for scoring, the extra actions on the cards, etc. If the whole game had that from the start, I think I would like the game a lot better. But combined, it felt a little overwhelming to me. But I think if the game itself had like those bonus scores on the cards for splaying and things like that, I think I would have liked the whole game better overall.
That's another thing with expansion. Sorry, go on.
I don't think I've ever played it as just the expansion, but I think it could potentially mechanically work.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if it could or not, because I know, obviously, based on the name, expansions are expanding the game, but some are standalone. I just didn't know if there were like enough cards or specific actions to make it standalone. But I don't know. I guess those little like extra bonuses to me, if that was just the game, I think I would have liked it more.
Mm-hmm.
Jonah, what did you think about Echoes?
Yeah, I thought Echoes was neat. I thought that it might have added, I don't know, I think because we played with an expansion on Tabletop Simulator, which was the harder of the two platforms for a new player to play on, I felt like Echoes added too much for me to really be able to keep track of things. Because just having to look at the top card and all the symbols was the right amount of information for my feeble brain to process. But having to look at the squares on the lower splayed over cards seemed to be a little more than I could handle. That is, of course, because it was my first time playing with it. I'm sure in future plays I would be totally fine with it. But that is a negative of expansions in general. They can be really tricky with new players.
I know that when I've played with all of the expansions, it made it more of a kind of a cooperative game mechanically, in that everyone had to pay attention and could point out, you should be drawing this type of card, because when there's five different sets to draw from, sometimes you should be drawing a certain set that you forget about, and if everyone's paying attention, then they can point that out.
Mm-hmm. With a lot of expansions as well, I think sometimes they just totally add way more than what's necessary. So for instance, Food Chain Magnate, I talk about every episode and it's awful, but the expansion, which I think is the greatest expansion for any game I've played, probably a correlation there, part of the expansion is a six-player
variant or an addition for six player. I would never, ever want to play that game with six players. That is way too much. I don't know why anyone would want to do that, and I think it's foolish. Similarly, the game Tolkien, which I quite enjoy, is a great 2-4 player game, and the expansion adds a fifth player for that. I don't think that game would be good with five players. Now, I have not tried either of these games with those player counts, but I also think both of those games felt full or just right at their base game full player count. Player counts.
I think I got what you mean.
I don't know if that last player counts was necessary.
I do appreciate an expansion that adds a fifth player if I'm going to have a five-player games day, though.
Right.
I think getting everyone around the table adds it.
Yeah, and I can't fault them for wanting to include more people, because then you're going to get more people to try out your game. Because plenty of times I'll play a game that, you know, in the before times at a game night, you'll whip out a game. How many people do we have? Five. What does that play? Four. Oh, dang. Let's go to something else. I totally understand wanting to defeat that situation. But sometimes a game should not have that many people in it. Agree? Disagree?
I agree. But I also think that player expansions are interesting in that when you play a game that works at five players, it also makes you think, is this just a cash grab? Why couldn't they just put five players in the base game? Because if the game works at five, why can't you just make the game 1-5 players or 2-5 players? Why can't you just include it?
Ben, I'm so glad you brought up cash grabs and expansions. Fantastic segue for something I want to talk about.
I've got some cash grabs to talk about because I like Kickstarter.
But I do want to,
I just want to ask, Jake, what is your favorite game expansion? I'd like to go through favorite game expansions before moving.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I have other stuff I wanted to talk about before cash grab expansions. So.
Oh, okay. We'll get there.
So I do enjoy the innovation expansions. And also, I found the first expansion set for Unfair has added a lot to the game.
I'd like to try Unfair sometime. It seems right up my alley. I love roller coasters and amusement parks and stuff. It just seems fun.
It's a fun fair. Unfair.
It's an unfair fun fair?
All of the above.
Maybe.
We'll organize a time.
Yeah, wait, I'm down to give it a shot.
Before we get to you, Ben.
Yes.
I want us to also each say why you love these expansions.
Okay.
Because I didn't say that about mine, and I want to hear it about both of yours.
Okay. Do you want me to go now, or do you want Jake to finish his thought?
I want Jake to finish his thought, because we keep interrupting him.
I'm sorry.
I think it adds a lot of variety and replayability to the games. Yeah, innovation adds the new mechanics. As you're talking about, you need to, for a tableau builder, you kind of need to know the cards. If I'm playing with the expansions that I haven't played with as much, I don't know those cards. So if I draw something, I need to think on the fly. I get excited about a new action that I can take that I didn't know about before.
Yeah, that's what's great about expansions to games you love. You get the wow factor for a game you might feel you've played enough. It really freshens it up. Sorry, go on. I'll stop.
And yeah, Unfair, it does add more variety, more combinations that didn't exist before.
So would you say, just really quick, would you say that the innovation expansions are shake it up or more of the same? And would you say, are the Unfair expansions shake it up or more of the same?
Innovation is shake it up. So as you saw with Echoes, the new mechanics there and some of the other ones have much more complex new mechanics. Unfair, for the sets that I've played, have been more the same with slight tweaks, but it really shifts the game style. So some of the decks are more about building big, others are about money. And then others are about attacking. So it really changes the flavor.
Cool. For me, I'm going to break my own rule here. And the rule for me is I don't like
expansions. Don't talk about Fight Club. Oh, sorry.
I don't like expansions that are required for the game to be playable, because that means the base game was not good.
And that means that's not an expansion.
However, I'm breaking my own rule because the best expansion that I have played has to be Shea Embers of a Forsaken Star, because it makes Shea playable. And Shea is one of my favorite games of all time. So I have to give Embers of a Forsaken Star my number one spot for expansions. It is 100% Shake It Up, because it completely changes the entire game. The base game, there was no economy board, so like you couldn't go around and buy and trade elements and cubes, which get you money to buy new things. The exploration tokens all just gave you a victory point, but in Embers of a Forsaken Star, they will give you other bonuses that totally change what can happen during the game. It adds a bunch of mission cards to the game. So there's a little bit of more of the same on top of Shake It Up, but it is literally like a fix for the base game, and it adds so many cool things. It adds comets that will go around the board, so it adds like more danger to going throughout the board. It adds a solo campaign, which is kind of wild. I haven't played the game solo before. But yeah, I'm breaking my own rule because usually I'm not a fan of expansions that are almost necessary to make the core game a good game. But I have to make an exception here. I would say that one is my favorite.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, one of the things I really wanted to say about expansions, which I'll just go into very briefly now, is a lot of the best expansions are ones that, you know, you say make the base game playable for Shea, but for a lot of other games, I think the best expansions are ones that fix a minor imperfection in the base game. So there's a game, A Feast for Odin, that is really good, and everyone says that with the Norwegians expansion, it just becomes that much better. It fixes things slightly in the base game, it changes what you can do, and it just really enhances the experience. So I think it's definitely great to have expansions that do that, and it's also a great little thought from the designers of the game. It's kind of like, yeah, we realized maybe we didn't do this so well, here is a fix, and in addition to that.
Another game that has an expansion coming out soon that I'm looking forward to along the lines of fixing a minor issue is Fantastic Factories. Mm-hmm. As I said, very multiplayer solitaire. The expansions that are coming out soon add a bit more interaction, but the designer has said that he understands that some people don't like attacking other players, so that's why it's an expansion that is fully optional.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Yeah, that'll be neat to see how it changes up the base game. Very briefly, Food Chain Magnate expansion. The Ketchup Mechanism is fantastic. It is a Shake It Up expansion without a doubt. And one thing that I really love about this expansion is that it is modular. And that means that it comes with 11 modules that you can mix and match and change up your gameplay experience every time. And I really enjoy that because you can look at these different modules and see how they interact and plan to play with these three this time, these two next time, these other four the time after that, and see how different the game plays each time. And I think that modular expansions are the best kind of expansions because it's like getting multiple expansions in one, which is really fun. And yeah, just to cover the more of the same, because we haven't talked about many more of the same, a lot of games like Star Realms, which is a deck builder, or Hero Realms, which is another deck builder, so I should think of another example, will just come with more cards. And that's great because, you know, if you love a game, getting more cards to put into your deck or more player abilities to add on to is great as well. It, you know, more of the same is fantastic. Twilight Imperium has an expansion coming out soon that has some Shake It Up in it, but it also just comes with 9 more alien races, which is fantastic, because you can say, I think these 17 alien races are super neat. Oh, wow, 9 more? Love it.
Yeah, I was going to have one more of the same, and that was Village Pillage. There is, like, a slight additional mechanic for the Surf and Turf. The name of the expansion is Surf and Turf. You could buy Surf or Turf, because it's two separate expansions. I bought both. The Surf adds a slight... Yeah. Surf adds a slight new mechanic in terms of, like, how cards react after they are played, but for the most part, it's just adding more cards. So the Surf cards are typically like boating based characters, I guess. So I'm looking at one right now. There's a diver, and the diver will, if it's played against another citrus, aka farmer, it will gain you 7 turnips, but then you have to sacrifice it because it abandons ship when it's done. It just like left your ship and it's gone. So like it adds that little bit, but for the most part it's just adding more cards for more variety.
Another more of the same expansion is on Beasts of Balance. So it's a dexterity stacking game where you're stacking plastic animals on a plinth. The expansions just have new animals to stack.
Is Beasts of Balance the one with like the app?
Yep.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. I knew there was one, but then there's also like another animal stacking game that I've seen that didn't have an app.
Yeah, Beasts of Balance is cool. I remember we played that when I was down there.
Down under?
Yes.
It was a good kind of filler. Get everyone around the table and have a laugh.
Mm-hmm. Before we get into the cash grab expansions, I just want to bring up a really famous stupid expansion. There is a game that I have not played that is a very well-known gateway game. It is French, and I speak French poorly, aka not at all. Carcassonne is the game. Have either of you played this?
Nope.
Yes, but I don't think with the expansion.
Well, this expansion is called Carcassonne the Catapult. Carcassonne is a tile-laying game with farming and other nonsense, probably, because I haven't played it. The Catapult expansion comes with a literal catapult that you put a chit into and catapult onto the field, and then it affects the play. And it is so widely hated by people who love the game, of which there are many, that I just wanted to bring it up, because sometimes people make stupid expansions.
Just comparing the new Fireball Island from Restoration Games, which is a remake of a... So Restoration Games remakes old out-of-print games.
They restores them.
Yeah. So Fireball Island, they remade, and I got it on Kickstarter. And Kickstarter... I'm going to talk about Kickstarter in the cash grab section easily. But this one... There was Crouching Tiger, Hidden Bees was the name of the expansion. And it was actually neat. It added some new stuff. But similarly to the catapult, there was literally, you know those old plastic, like, tabletop toys for kids where, like, when you press on the tail, it'll, like, flex the legs, and when you let it go, it'll jump forward? Mm-hmm. I don't even know what those are called. A popper, that works. But they literally made a tiger popper. And you could put it off the side of the map, and you would try and hit other players' miniatures, and if you knocked them over, it would be like a bonus or like a detriment to that player, which I thought was very similar to the catapult, but it was actually really fun because that game is very whimsical.
Right. I mean, Fireball Island has like rolling marbles and plastic flames, and it's very much that type of a game.
Yes.
So that expansion makes perfect sense.
Yes.
But for the catapult, everyone was just like, what are you thinking? Why is this made for this?
Yep.
Is it actually because most Carcassonne players are fans of the superior siege weapon, the trebuchet?
It can throw a 90 kilogram payload 300 meters.
All right, let's talk about cash grabs. And
yes, please.
My intro to the cash grab segment is expansions on Kickstarter. I typed something up about this, Ben.
Yeah, I'm surprised your intro to cash grab expansions isn't just defer to Ben.
Hi, my name is Jake, and I'm also a Kickstarter-holic.
Perfect. Hi, right, Jake.
You can chime in very shortly. What I wrote is that expansions, in quotes, very important quotes, on Kickstarter are really just the rest of the full game. This is what Ben already said earlier. I don't think that that is the case at all with retail releases. And on Kickstarter, they have expansions that, of course, cost more money than the base game because it's an expansion. So you have to pay more to get it because it's not the base game. And Kickstarter preys upon people with FOMO, and people will design a full game. This is my opinion and also the opinion of a lot of people. People will design a full game to bring to Kickstarter. They will chop off the final 20% of it and offer that as an expansion that costs more money. And since you two are the Kickstarter experts, I will let you guys chat about the, 100 examples of this.
I'm going to just come right out and say the biggest offender, in my opinion, for all of this stuff is Cool Mini or Not. I think Cool Mini or Not is the ultimate FOMO generator on Kickstarter, and most people would probably agree. And I would like to use Exhibit A, which is Rising Sun.
Oh, not Blood Rage?
Blood Rage, I didn't have any experience with the Blood Rage Kickstarter. I bought the retail game. So the first one that I got in with was Rising Sun. And while Kickstarter, in my opinion, and Kickstarter exclusives are a whole other conversation, but my problem with Cool Mini or Not is a lot of times they make these expansions Kickstarter exclusive. Which means if you do not back the game on Kickstarter, you literally cannot buy the expansion. So what you will see is the Kickstarter expansion that cost me $50 to get during the Kickstarter, people are selling for $250 after the Kickstarter because it completes the game. And it's
which feels
wild.
Bad for a lot of people.
Yes, it feels bad for a lot of people. But to expand upon this, most of the cash grab expansions are also unplay-tested pieces of junk. So, for example, I will use Blood Rage for that example.
Oh, I thought you were going to continue with Rising Sun.
I mean, I can. I can also continue with Rising Sun because there's one example in Rising Sun as well. But in Blood Rage, there were Kickstarter-exclusive monsters, and one of them was Fenrir, which is like the mythical wolf in Nordic mythology. In the game Blood Rage, at the end of each era, there is a portion of the game called Ragnarok where one location gets destroyed and you cannot use it for the rest of the game. The Kickstarter exclusive expansion for Fenrir literally moved Ragnarok from where it's supposed to go to wherever you play Fenrir. So it literally let somebody completely blow up the game and just move around where things were supposed to happen when it's very, very set in the mechanics. Ragnarok is happening here at the end of the round, and someone can just go, boom, I'm going to put Fenrir out and like blow up the game. And people were not a huge fan of that because, I mean, there's literally card strategies that are based around Ragnarok, and that expansion completely breaks the game in that regard. So there are a lot of expansions that can also just break a game.
I don't have any game-breaking Kickstarter expansions, but one of the kind of cash grabs that I'm not a fan of is when the game comes out, expansions come out, then the full game comes out, and so you finally think, I will just get the full game with all the expansions. And then 6 months later, another expansion comes out. So I'm personally thinking Star Realms here. I enjoyed it a lot. It started as, a $10
oh my God,
deck
yeah.
building game.
Yep.
I've got, what's this? It's almost an A3 box full of cards. I got the full version, and then as an add-on to a completely different campaign, there is another expansion.
Are you talking about that Jungle Realms or Epic, whatever, that's out now, and then they're adding Star Realms High Frontier or something like that? Yeah, that's, I agree. Yep, because I also have
the big all box three of us Star have Realms. The big box for Star Realms.
Yep, but I backed that campaign just to get the Star Realms stuff, and it's
done. Oh, they got you.
Well, yeah, because I have a problem.
Thinker.
But another one along those lines, and for me, this is a bigger one, is. And it's part of Kickstarter as a whole, where I think Kickstarter is definitely a cash grab as a whole. Just to go back to Fireball Island really quickly, there were two things about Fireball Island. One, they put out an all-in pledge, which, like you said, is everything that FOMO. They offer. Yes, FOMO. They usually offer it at a slight discount compared to buying the bits individually on the Kickstarter campaign.
Just really quickly, in case people don't know what FOMO is, fear of missing out.
Yes.
I think it's a common thing, but anyway.
Yep. Basically, that means is I don't want to miss out on all of these parts that might be exclusive, so I back now because I am a weak person. But Fireball Island, and I knowingly went into Fireball Island knowing none of this was exclusive, except for like a tiny deck of cards, which is fine with me. Little things like that, cool. Kickstarter exclusives, it's a whole other conversation. But for Fireball Island, they put out the full bundle at, I think it cost $140 for the full bundle with all expansions and everything included. Only for them to also offer a broken token insert, which is a fully wooden laser cut insert that fits everything. And it's a crate, so it literally replaces the box entirely. And you put all of the stuff in the crate, and it holds everything. Little did we know that they released the box with the description holds everything for Fireball Island, and then Restoration Games releases another expansion, which doesn't fit into the crate, but they knew the crate was being made when they were designing the expansion, and let them keep up the description fits everything for Fireball Island. So that bit's frustrating, because you go in for these expansions, and then why does a game need six expansions? So, like, it turns into a cash grab because the game is basically finished, but they're just like, oh, we got all these people on FOMO, and because they went for the all-in pledge, we know we can release another expansion, and those people will probably buy it.
And it's just planned obsolescence.
Yeah. Meanwhile, I sold the game once I saw the expansion came out. I sold the crate. I sold the game. I sold it.
Washed your hands and you were done with it.
Yeah, but that one rubbed me the wrong way. Aside from the fact that the game was in retail for $80 for everything after I paid $140 for it on Kickstarter, so that was fun too. Which is why people go for the exclusives, for the FOMO. Because if it's not in retail, you're getting the game. But if you wait, it's going to be cheaper in retail. But who can wait, Jonah? Who can wait?
I can wait.
Did you say that Blood on the Clock Tower had expansions that you had issues with as well?
Yes, but I am that sucker that managed to find out that Patrick was able to add another copy on in the pledge manager, so it kind of ended up being okay. But I had issues.
It's okay because it worked out for you.
It's okay because it worked out for me, but I have issues that the game is so delayed and they're releasing a full copy at the full price that people paid during the Kickstarter that's super delayed, but you're not getting 30 something characters. And they even put in the Kickstarter campaign, we will not release these for months, possibly even years after the game hits retail.
I will say, as someone who did back this, I did not back it because of the expansions at all. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
So while the expansions for a lot of things are meant to bring people in, I played the base game. I thought it was great. I backed it. Then I found out that there were expansions, and I was like, neat.
But would you, if you were on the reverse, because this is a good question for you, because you are one to not really back much on Kickstarter, and this is another complaint about expansions, if you bought Blood on the Clock Tower later and found out you were going to have to wait years for the same stuff to come to kick, like that was in the Kickstarter, but you had to wait years for it and you paid the same amount, would that annoy you?
You're not going to like the answer, but no, only because I think that base game has so much, I don't want to say depth because it's a social deduction game, but it has so much replayability with all the character combos that I really feel like I could get multiple years out of just the base characters, especially with, you know, how many times am I going to get a group of 7+ together to play this one game? And will I get a group together so many times that we exhaust the base game? I don't think so.
That's fair. I was going to wait because when you were talking about the more of the same and how we weren't discussing many of them, most of the, what I've found at least, because I'm a Kickstarter addict, is that most of the more of the sames are Kickstarter expansions because, like you said, it feels like bits of the game were chopped off and added in as expansions. So mm-hmm. a lot of the Kickstarter games are just like more miniatures, more factions, more cards, as opposed to like this expansion fixes something, because how can you fix something that isn't released yet?
Right.
So it's just a lot of more of the same on
Kickstarter. Yeah, I mean, I think that expansions have become more modular as the hobby has progressed, because, I mean, I think games are changing a lot as well, but I think more of the same is really fine, because a lot of the times, like I was saying for Star Realms and Twilight Imperium, like, it really is just, we have 10 cool things, here are 5 more cool things. You know, sure, it's going to shake the game up a little bit, but it's not so much of a change to the base game. Like, you know, the expansion for Shia, that is really released to change up the base game. Whereas other ones, it's just like, oh, you like these 5 characters? Here are a few more.
Yeah.
So.
My biggest issue with expansions in general is just, you buy one, and now you need a place to store the expansion. So now you need to 3D print inserts, buy inserts, find more space, buy a new Kallax shelf from IKEA. It's, I mean, expansions just tumble you down the rabbit hole of having to find places to keep it all.
That is it for today's episode of Jonah and Ben Play Board Games with Friends. Thank you, Jake, for joining us all the way down from tomorrow.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. If you want to send us a strongly worded email about expansions, you can do so at jonahbenpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And Jake, you will have to thank Louisa yourself for the excellent music on this episode.
Thanks, Louisa, for the excellent music on this episode.
In person, of course.
Lockdowns.